Now we present Are You There, Harry Price?
Whoever or whatever you are, I would ask you to reply through the usual code. 3 taps for yes, 1 tap for no, and 2 if you are in doubt. Do you understand?
This week marks the centenary of the birth of Harry Price, ghost hunter and psychical researcher. June Noxmore has been examining some of the highlights of his extraordinary career and the way people remember him today.
He had to be top dog. He was a showman. And if anyone upset him in the slightest or wanted anything different from what he wanted, out they'd go and he'd be very rude to them.
Well, I think he's just head and shoulders above everybody else.
I regard him as a disaster area, I'm afraid. He probably set back the cause of psychical research by something like half a century.
It's a tantalizing thing, because to try and grasp the whole roundness of Price's character is a bit like chasing a piece of mercury across a tea tray.
Harry Price died 33 years ago, and he's still as elusive and contradictory a character as he was in his heyday of the 20s, 30s and 40s. He made his name as an investigator of spiritualist mediums, but he went on to focus popular attention on all kinds of psychic phenomena, from the so-called talking mongoose to the ghosts of Bawley Rectory, the most haunted house in England. But what lay behind Price's compulsion, his drive to define these shadowy boundaries of mind and matter? The whole of Harry Price's life was to be a seesaw between scepticism and belief, as far as the supernatural was concerned. Any kind of balance was made even more difficult by the extraordinary egotism of his character. At 21, he listed the following ambitions.
1. I wanted to be a writer, and to write especially for the Encyclopedia Britannica. 2. I wanted to appear in Who's Who. 3. I wanted to collect the largest magical library in existence. 4. I wanted to be offered a doctorate of some university. 5. I wanted to possess a Rolls-Royce car. Above all, I remember, I wished to experience the thrill of being interviewed, and I wanted to collect press cuttings about myself. I must have been very vain.
The role of psychic investigator that was to bring him such fame had already begun. He was only 15 when he hunted his very first ghost, a poltergeist or noisy spirit, in a certain manor house in Shropshire. The sound of heavy footsteps on the stairs, night after night, had finally driven the owner to leave. Price's idea was simple. Whatever it was, he'd get it on film. He was already an expert photographer, but this was an occasion for real ingenuity. The camera was placed halfway up the stairs, with the flash mixture nearby packed into an old watch case. Having searched and sealed the whole house, Price and a friend retreated into the morning room. There they closed the door and waited in darkness as the sound of footsteps began.
When I estimated that the thumps were halfway up the stairs, I pressed the switch that I held in my hand. Then an extraordinary thing happened. In addition to the expected flash and explosion, whatever it was on the stairs distinctly stumbled. At the same time, a clattering down the stairs of some object made us hope that we had shot the poltergeist to pieces. For some moments we were too startled to do anything. There was no sign of the ghost or the watch case. This we found later on the stairs. The force of the explosion had projected the case up the stairs and it had rolled down again. That was the clattering noise we heard. I regret to report that there was nothing on the negative except a picture of an overexposed staircase. But the trip had been worthwhile, as very definitely we had contacted a real ghost in a real haunted house.
Even so, there would have been a number of false starts in Price's ghost-hunting career. He'd been trained in engineering, and during the First World War he ran his own munitions workshop. He dabbled in coin collecting and archaeology. But all the time, he was drawn back to that mysterious borderland between reality and illusion. Magic and conjuring fascinated him, and he became skilled at both. It gave a special edge to his observations of the seedier seance rooms around London, where fake mediums traded on the bereavements of the war. A grand scheme began to take shape in his mind, of a laboratory where psychic phenomena could be scientifically tested and investigated. the articles he wrote on these themes began to be noticed. In 1923, he was invited to Austria to see an extraordinary young medium called Willy Schneider, whose brother, Rudi, was to develop even more remarkable powers. At these sessions, attended by a number of distinguished observers, Price tried out his new system of checks. Rudi was bound hand and foot with an electrical control that immobilized not only the medium, but the circle of sitters, too.
Under these merciless conditions of control, we witnessed the following phenomena. The intelligent movements, sometimes to order, of waste paper basket, handbell, toy, zither, handkerchief, etc. All these objects were right out of reach of medium or any sitter. The tying of knots in handkerchiefs. Writing on paper by pseudopod or teleplasmic terminals like hands. Violent movements of tables. Loud raps and knocks on table, chairs, etc. The production of luminous masses, a thing like a snowman, a chocolate-coloured leg, and a leg that appeared to be triangular.
Amidst a blaze of publicity, Rudi came to England to demonstrate. Over the next few years, he became almost the property of Harry Price. And then, with that characteristic ambivalence of his, Price destroyed the whole image that he'd worked so feverishly to establish. In 1932, he produced a photograph that revealed Rudi apparently freeing an arm from his bindings in order to achieve his famous effects. Price attributed the lapse to Rudi's declining powers, but it nevertheless became a cause célèbre. There were suggestions that Price had manufactured the exposure for his own ends. This is a theory strongly endorsed by the psychologist Anita Gregory. As secretary of the Society for Psychical Research, she's made an intensive study of the case.
There can be, in my view, no doubt at all that the exposure was fraudulent. Exactly how it was done is still somewhat obscure. Between, I think, April 33, or March 33, when Price suddenly published his denunciation, and the séance about a year previously, when it was supposed to have happened, between these dates, Price had vouched to all and sundry, including the editor of Nature, the Times, you name it, for the total and complete authenticity of Rudi. So he simply must have been lying. Either he lied when he denounced him, or he lied in between when he vouched for the genuineness.
What are your own views upon that photograph, though, Anita?
First of all, there's only two possibilities. Either it was faked from beginning to end. It was faked with a dummy, and it was faked quite carefully. The alternative is that it was an accident, but Price kept it as a rod in pickle in case the medium and his rival Society of Psychical Research investigator didn't come to heel, and he used it as a whip. Now, I am inclined to the fake photograph theory, although others have challenged me on that one.
What do you think are the reasons for the fake itself? I mean, the psychological and the practical reasons for it.
Price thought that there was a glory to be had from being the sole scientific advocate. He felt that corroboration, scientific corroboration from others would detract from him in this respect. Which I think was almost certainly an error. I don't think it would have done. I think it would have given him considerable credit. But for him, who came, as he did, outside the sort of scientific, scholarly establishment, corroboration wasn't something that he wanted. He wanted a scoop rather than a piece in a chain of scholarly investigation.
Anita Gregory, someone who was actually with Harry Price at the seances held at the Schneider's home in Austria was Mrs. Molly Goldney, a leading figure of the Society for Psychical Research. She's now in her 80s, but the experience remains clear in her mind, especially the kind of precautions that were taken before each of Rudi's demonstrations.
We'd stuffed up the keyhole and we'd barred all the windows, and then this mist just came slowly across from one end of the room like that, went right up to the end Rudi was in, and then very slowly went back again and disappeared.
That was something that convinced you, actually.
Well, oh yes, I mean, the mist couldn't have come from anywhere, you see. It was a thick fog, you couldn't have seen through it. Mm-hmm. And things that we'd put on the floor were blacked out, whitened out by it. It was like a Scottish mist where you wouldn't be able to see 5 inches ahead of you. It was like that. Mm-hmm. I can't say what the explanation was. Whether that was due to some force in Rudi or not, I don't know. But what else could it have been?
Why was it that Price decided to
sort of reveal the Schneiders as frauds, as he claimed, by publishing photographs of them faking their effects.
But making sure they'd come back again. He'd say, now you've got to come back again, you know, or your reputation's spoiled. You can't leave yourself under a crowd like that, you know, Rudy, because, I mean, your reputation would be spoiled. Everyone would think you were a fraud.
But Rudy Schneider's reputation never recovered, nor did his apparent powers, and he disappeared from the scene of psychical research. About this time, though, Price met a young medium he could truly claim as his own personal discovery. He called her Stella C. They met on a train, Price related, where she told him about the mysterious phenomena she was capable of causing. Flashes of light, icy breezes, even the movement of objects around her. Soon, with overtones of Svengali and Trilby, Price was holding seances to demonstrate her curious gifts. These included incidents of clairvoyance, one in particular on April the 12th, 1923, when Stella claimed to see in a vision the front page of the Daily Mail headed May the 19th. She described in detail an advertisement for Andrew's liver salts, which was prominent on the page. It depicted a boy in tears spilling a tin of the salts. 5 weeks later, there was an extraordinary sequel.
I had forgotten all about the advertisement, but upon looking at the Daily Mail for May the 19th, 1923, I saw Stella's visualized advertisement of Andrew's salt exactly as described at the seance. During our exhaustive inquiries into the matter, it was revealed that an advertisement for Andrew's had been received by the Daily Mail for publication on May the 19th, but the prominent feature of this advertisement was the picture of a large statue of Abraham Lincoln. Then the firm which owned the Andrews liver salt suddenly informed the Daily Mail that another picture, the one Stella described, was to be substituted. This latter picture was not even decided upon, said the Daily Mail, until several days after the seance. The advertising manager of this paper wrote me that his department was deeply impressed by Stella's spontaneous prediction.
But once again, there are those who've taxed Price with fraud. Peter Bond has been researching material for a book on Stella C, and he believes he's found a fatal flaw in the story.
The letter from the managing director of Andrew's Liver Salts makes it perfectly clear that the contents of the advertisement could have been known by people in London at the time, and that, on its own, is sufficient evidence to prove that the advertisement could have been known by normal means, and it was suppressed and never mentioned by anybody at the time of the sittings.
So what you're suggesting really then is that Price actually manufactured all this evidence?
I think manipulated might be a better word. I think you can manipulate evidence to say all sorts of things.
What puzzles me is why Price, the arch debunker of mediums, should choose to believe so wholeheartedly in this particular one.
I think in 1923 he'd learnt sufficiently from others that psychic research was his true vocation in life, and it was where he could make his mark, and he very much wanted to make his mark in the world, and he wanted to be considered an academic among other things, and he'd found the subject that suited him down to the ground. Stella launched him on his career. In 1926, she launched him on his new grandly styled National Laboratory for Psychical Research, which was opened with great gusto in January of that year, and she was the first medium that he sat with at his new laboratory. And after that, I think she was beginning to outlive her usefulness, and in any case, she didn't like sitting at all. And in 1928, she was getting married, and she left psychic research altogether.
The laboratory, which Price had founded, designed, and equipped, was the first such centre in Britain. January the 21st, 1926, was the great opening day, and the crowds around number 16 Queensbury Place in Kensington were so thick that many had to be turned away.
An amusing feature of the evening was the number of fake mediums who turned up and furtively examined the instruments of torture, as one of them termed it, that were to be used on them. An electromechanical seance chair that recorded when a medium was not sitting on it, when he should have been, was closely studied by more than one charlatan who had had successes among the credulous.
The laboratory, which was eventually transferred to the University of London, is still regarded as something of a milestone. Peter Underwood is one of today's best-known writers on the supernatural and a successor of Price's as president of the Ghost Club, and he finds much to admire in Price's methods.
Well, I think they were very scientific for the days which he was operating in. He wasn't a scientist, but he was very ingenious in his methods. I mean, these gloves, you know, that he invented, really, metal gloves, which the medium and all sitters used, and they were all wired up, and so if anybody moved a hand, immediately a light flashed and bell rang and so on. He had shoes too, which were wired up so that if there was any movement of the feet, that would be shown, and he had another wiring form, I remember, which caused any movement, then immediately a camera flashed and a photograph was taken showing movement. This was criticised later on, but I think he was trying to do it in a scientific spirit.
The laboratory was to be the setting of some extraordinary displays, psychic and otherwise. There was the grand denouement of the Scottish medium, Helen Duncan, 17 stone in her voluminous black séance combinations. The so-called teleplasm issuing from her lips was snipped off with the scissors and found to be a compound of tissue paper and egg white. There was the American George Valentine, whose famous spirit thumbprint turned out to be an inked print of the gentleman's big toe. And there was an Italian phenomenon known as the human squib. The squib was renowned for the mysterious sparks and flames he could produce at will, but his reputation was dampened forever with the discovery of minute particles of flint and steel concealed about his person in places, as Price put it, not mentioned in polite society. But this farcical element had no part in the kind of seances given by mediums of the reputation of Eileen Garrett. There was one evening that made an unforgettable impression on Price and everyone else concerned. October the 7th, 1930. 2 days before, the revolutionary new British airship, the R-101, had crashed in flames over France. At the séance, almost as soon as Eileen Garrett went into trance, a voice came through, purporting to be the dead captain of the airship, Lieutenant Irwin. The message he had to deliver was urgent and dramatic.
Never mind about me, but do, for heaven's sake, give this to them. The whole bulk of the dirigible was entirely and absolutely too much for her engine capacity. Engines too heavy. Useful lift too small. Gross lift computed badly. Inform control panel. And this idea of new elevators totally mad. Elevator jammed. Oil pipe plugged. This exorbitant scheme of carbon and hydrogen is entirely and absolutely wrong. Weather bad, fabric all waterlogged and ship's nose is down. Impossible to rise, cannot trim, almost scrape the roofs at Ashi. You will understand that I had to tell you. From beginning of trouble I knew we had not a chance, not a chance.
The newspapers, of course, had given headline coverage of the crash, but the technical secrets behind its cause were not revealed until many weeks later, nor was the fact that the airship sank so low at Ashi, a tiny village near Beauvais, unmarked on all the major maps. This evidence was also confirmed at the official inquiry. Price was as mystified as he was impressed.
Where did this information come from? As Mrs. Garrett did not know one end of an airship from the other, and the sitters too possessed no technical knowledge of such things, it is quite certain that the facts about the R-101 emanated from an external source. There is no evidence that it was the discarnate Irwin speaking, but there is a well-known theory that some portion of the mind of a deceased person may linger on for an indefinite period. If that person was in dire distress at the time of passing, it is conceivable that the persisting remnant of his mind or ego might register itself on or combine with the mind of some living person sensitive enough to receive it.
Later on, at the same séance, there was someone else with a message for Price. This time it was more of a social call. Through her spirit guide, Uvani, Eileen Garrett announced that the late Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was preparing to make contact. Sir Arthur had died just 3 months before, and he and Price had quarrelled, publicly and privately, for the last 10 years or so. Doyle as an avowed spiritualist, Price as the scourge of every medium with something to hide. But there had been times of reconciliation, and this, it seemed, was to be one of them. After a pause, the voice of Uvani changed, and something like Doyle's bluff tones came through. A genial conversation followed, with Doyle expounding first on the problems of communication from the world beyond.
I did not recognize the difficulty there would be in getting through this wall or density that stands between us. I would like you to know my location, that I am in a nebulous belt lying outside the Earth's surface and having life and being because it is of the same structure and matter as the Earth itself. I am in no doubt as to my geographical position.
I am very pleased that my old antagonist has come back.
No reason why you should be. It was your fault that we disagreed.
But we were working really with the same object in view, but in different ways. I am trying to arrive at the truth.
I was always wondering what you were working for, to be perfectly candid. I always had my eye on you, and you used to watch me like a cat sitting watching a bird in a cage. It was I who kept spiritualism going by my money.
Well, Sir Arthur, I am as much out of pocket during the past 5 years as you were.
Then, my dear sir, we may shake hands.
Price also found an ideal platform for himself with the revived Ghost Club, whose members vied with each other's hair-raising stories over the dinner table. Respected public figures were now taking a serious interest in his investigations. Dr. C. E. M. Joad, Professor Julian Huxley, the scientist Sir Richard Gregory, and Sir Edward Marshall Hall, K.C. At the same time, his books were being lapped up by a public avid for wonders. Leaves from a Psychist's Notebook, Confessions of a Ghost Hunter, first serialized in The Listener. In the popular press, too, the stocky, balding figure with the saturnine features and piercing eyes was a favorite subject with the photographers, tying up mediums, laying traps for poltergeists, examining the bite marks of the devil girl from Romania, tracing the ghostly music at a Brixton nightclub to the cinema next door. And then Price embarked on his most celebrated case of all, one that was to involve him off and on for the rest of his life. The house was Borley Rectory in Essex, built in 1863 on a much earlier site. Ever since its first occupant, the Reverend Henry Bull, moved in, there'd been sightings of strange apparitions, a phantom nun, a ghostly coach with a headless coachman. Bull's son, Harry, who succeeded him, reported unexplained footsteps and bell ringing. The dining room window was apparently walled over because the nun's appearances outside tended to disturb family meals. In 1929, after a tenancy of 9 months, the next incumbent, the Reverend Eric Smith, appealed through the Daily Mirror for help in discouraging the ghostly intruders. Price was obviously the man for the job. With his secretary, he arrived at Borley on June the 12th, and there met up with a Mirror reporter named Wall. Together with the Smiths, they searched every room for unusual sights or sounds, then went out into the grounds. In the dusk, the hardened pressman swore he saw a shadowy figure moving along the path known as the Nun's Walk. Price was less sure, but there was no doubt at all about the kind of reception they were given when they went back to the house.
We had just set foot under the veranda when a terrific crash was heard, and one of the thick glass panes from the roof fell in pieces at our feet and splashed us with splinters. Very startled, we sought for a possible missile, and found a piece of brick or tile on the floor of the veranda. We hurried upstairs and again made a search of the rooms and windows. We found our seals intact and everything in order. We descended by the main staircase and had just reached the hall when another crash was heard, and we found that a red glass candlestick, one of a pair we had just seen on the mantelpiece of the blue room, had been hurled down the main stairs, had struck the iron stove, and had finally disintegrated into 1,000 fragments on the hall floor. Later, in quick succession and in full light, the following articles came tumbling down the stairs. First of all, some common seashore pebbles, then a piece of slate, then some more pebbles.
The stone throwing, repeated on other visits, was to become a major controversy in the Borley story. The rumour began that Price himself was responsible for staging these effects. Maurice Barbanel, editor of Psychic News, who knew Price and Borley well, recalls the occasion.
They were typical poltergeist phenomena. But then there's the very, very sad story told by Charles Sutton, a reporter on the Daily Mail, who was there with Price one day, and there were stones being thrown about, and Sutton said he saw Harry Price take some stones out of his pocket and throw them. He went back to the Daily Mail, but the lawyer looking for libel killed the story. He said, you can't print that whilst Harry Price is alive.
But Peter Underwood has studied the Borley case for 30 years, and he opposes the story strongly.
This, to me, is absolutely ludicrous, because a man of Price's stature and of his conjuring ability, if he couldn't do anything better to impress a gullible journalist and throw a few stones about, and then do it so badly that he was caught, I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Whatever the truth of these stone-throwing episodes, Borley was not slow to provide Price with fresh wonders. Later that very first evening, bells rang of their own volition, keys sprang out of their locks, and finally, Price and the rest of the party went up to the notorious Blue Room for an impromptu séance. For some time, the circle waited silently in the lamplight.
Just as we were wondering whether we were wasting our time, a faint, though sharp and decisive, tap was heard coming from apparently the wooden back of the mirror. Then came a succession of short, quick taps, and I made a little speech to the entity, thanking it for revealing its presence and asking whether it would answer certain questions. I suggested that the time-honoured three taps for yes and one tap for no, and two taps if the answer were doubtful or unknown should be employed. Mr. Wall suggested we ask it if it was the Reverend Harry Bull, the late rector. Three hurried taps came onto the mirror, which meant an emphatic yes. The following dialogue then took place. Is it your footsteps one hears in this house? Are you worrying about something that you should have done when you were alive? If we had a medium here, do you think you could tell us what is the matter?
Not only mediums, but investigators, both amateur and professional, descended on Borley. Among them, Molly Goldney. By this time, a new rector, the Reverend L.A. Foister, had taken up residence with his wife Marianne, and the poltergeist seemed to acquire fresh energy. Crockery was smashed, fires started, and beds overturned. Strangest of all, penciled writing began to appear on the walls, scrawled messages addressed to Marianne, asking for help, lights, and mass. About these, Mrs. Goldney has a theory that's shared by others, too.
It was the Marianne, absolutely certain.
The wife of the incumbent there?
Yes. Mm. She was young, and he was an old man, you know, and very fond of her and believed in her and that, but there was no doubt about it. The things at Borley weren't genuine. I mean, the writings on the wall and all that thing, they weren't genuine at all. I know one time people dressed up as the ghost, and everybody thought it was the real ghost and were in fits about it, but we knew perfectly well that it was somebody simply dressed up in the dark at night.
Do you think Harry Price actually believed there were ghosts at Borley himself?
He believed in anything that it required an investigation. And when the investigation came, he had to do it, and it would be written up so to make it extremely interesting and make other people come and, you know, want to attend everything that he did. But I shouldn't think he'd believe in a ghost.
Perhaps not. And yet, when the house was empty again in 1937, he rented it himself for a year and issued his observers with precise instructions as to the correct procedure on encountering an apparition. He had them printed, and they're now in the Harry Price Library, a favourite item of the curator, Alan Wizencraft.
Under the heading Forms for Apparitions, he tells you what to do. He says, if seen, do not move and on no account approach the figure. Note exact method of appearance, observe figure carefully, watch all movements, rate and manner of progression, etc. Note duration of appearance, colour, form, size, how addressed, and whether solid or transparent. Inquire if it is a spirit. Ask figure to return, suggesting exact time and place. Do not move until figure disappears. Note exact method of vanishing. If through an open door, quietly follow. If through solid objects, such as wall, ascertain if still visible on the other side. Now, I don't think a man could have written that and really be sincere. I think his tongue was in his cheek.
Tongue in cheek it might be, but Price believed in many of the strange powers of Borley, which continued even after the house was destroyed by fire in 1939. His book, The Most Haunted House in England, was a bestseller, as was its sequel, The End of Borley Rectory. As for any personal encounter with ghosts, there was one occasion when, briefly, far away from Borley, the real thing seemed to have touched him at last. A woman who claimed to be able to materialise the spirit of her dead child, Rosalie, invited him to a private séance. It was held at the London home of her friend, Mrs. X, and before it started, Price took all his usual stringent precautions. Finally, the lights were switched off, and the only illumination came from four phosphorescent hand mirrors lying on the floor.
Mrs. X leant towards me and whispered, "Rosalie is here. Don't speak." At the same moment, I realized that there was something quite close to me. I seemed to smell something that was not there previously. It was a strange, not unpleasant smell. The next sound I heard was a sort of shuffling of feet. Something slightly touched the back of my left hand. It felt soft and a little warm. I stretched out my left arm, and to my amazement, it came in contact with apparently the nude figure of a little girl. I lifted Rosalie's right arm and felt her pulse. I put my ear to her chest and could distinctly hear her heart beating. Mrs. X held a mirror to the side of the girl. I could see the soft texture of the flesh, which appeared to be without a blemish. As our mirrors travelled upwards, the face was revealed, and we beheld a beautiful child, who would have graced any nursery in the land. The mother said the examination must now cease, as Rosalie was wanted.
Later, Harry Price was to have afterthoughts about Rosalie. He wrote that he was not entirely satisfied with the phenomena. As far as he was concerned, the case was incomplete, as further investigation had been unwelcome and difficult. But at the time, there was no doubt at all about the kind of impression made on him, as Maurice Barbanel recalls.
He was obviously shaken by it, because his secretary told me, when I wrote in the heat of the controversy, that when Harry Price arrived in what he called his National Laboratory of Psychical Research in Kensington the next day, he was still shaken by the materialization he had witnessed, which was of a small child. He was quite satisfied that he had seen the independent materialization of this child at a non-professional mediumistic seance.
Price's investigations were not confined to the field of spiritualism. Any story of the paranormal and the mysterious drew him like a magnet, from Indian firewalkers to Oriental fakirs who buried themselves alive. It was all ideal material for the Gaumont British newsreels. There were broadcasts too, but sadly none seem to have survived in today's sound archives at the BBC. The lunatic fringe was in constant touch with Price, the lady who offered to demolish Hitler with the power of her thought waves, a gentleman with an invention called the psychic telephone, and someone living in the Isle of Man with news of a talking mongoose. The animal had apparently attached itself to a local family who claimed it could not only speak but read, sing hymns, and converse in a variety of languages and roles. Price's initial reaction was the same as Molly Goldney's.
Well, that was nonsense, you see. How could a mongoose know Cleopatra and speak five or six European languages? It was nonsense, but it was showmanship.
Showmanship or not, the story was investigated. Price himself went over to the Isle of Man with his friend R.S. Lambert, the famous editor of The Listener, to which Price was a regular contributor. Alas, Jeff, as the mongoose was called, was never at home on these occasions. But still the stories multiplied, and finally the invisible mongoose became the central figure in a sensational libel case, in which Lambert fought to clear his good name as a reliable journalist and BBC man. He was awarded substantial damages, and there was a parliamentary board of inquiry which recommended sweeping reforms at Broadcasting House in the field of staff relations. So the mysterious Jeff had accomplished something at least. And when the talking mongoose faded from the papers, there was no shortage of other Harry Price items to replace him.
The two most amusing pictures I've seen of Harry Price were the one taken on that ridiculous escapade on the Brocken, and the other when he had himself photographed in a bed with Dr. C.E.M. Joad, just to show that it was not haunted. It looked like a scene out of a West End musical comedy.
But the Brocken thing concerned the goat and the maiden.
Well, the Brocken thing was really the acme of his publicity, because it had no real reference to psychical research. It was an obscure, oblique reference to witchcraft in which Harry Price, in evening dress for some unknown reason, was on the Brocken in the Harz Mountains of Germany and invited all the journalists and photographers who would care to come along when he was going to demonstrate within a magic ring that if he placed what he called a pure virgin and had bat's blood and scrapings of church bells, and there was also a goat, even at the stroke of midnight, the goat would not change into a handsome young man.
Well, it's a sort of pure theatre, isn't it, really?
He adored the publicity, however ridiculous that it was. I must say, I liked Harry Price because he had a sense of humour, although we sat on opposite side of the fence.
Alongside the stunts and the investigations, Price was at work on the most serious of all his ambitions, collecting the largest private library of magical books in existence. Today, these 15,000 books and pamphlets are housed at the University of London, consulted by scholars and researchers from all over the world. When I went there, eight stories up in the Senate House, it was like visiting the Magician's Tower. Price's personality dominates every shelf, from the calf-bound volumes of Nostradamus to rare editions of witch-hunting manuals of the 16th and 17th centuries. In other cabinets are his famous scrapbooks, theatre bills, histories of conjuring, ventriloquism, and freak shows, and hidden away in drawers his séance relics, a voice trumpet, telepathy cards, and a sinister wooden object known as the Rapping Hand. I felt very cold in there. Mr. Wesencraft, the librarian, said it was rather warm, but he did admit that few of the female assistants were eager to visit the library after hours once it was dark. The books, of course, are immensely valuable, and Price's methods of acquiring them were often ingenious.
This story of how he brought a lot of books back from Germany is extremely interesting. This was in the 20s when Germany was going through a terrible time, as you know, when the money was disappearing daily and you took a sack full of notes to get a loaf of bread and all this sort of thing. And he managed to buy an enormous lot of very valuable books. But in order to get them out of the country, he had to pay a very, very heavy duties, you see. So he thought, well, I think I'll see if I can get the passengers of the train to cooperate. So he walked through the train with his book and gave each passenger one book. He said, would you mind holding this for about half an hour? And passengers of June in those days quite happy to do so. And so when the customs officials came through, they just thought that the train was full of very studious people, you see. Well, this shows, of course, a certain very strong ingenuity and a certain brashness, because I don't think I would go through a train asking people to hold a book for half an hour. Whatever Price was, he deserves our undying gratitude for having accumulated this superb library, this unique library, I think. People who use it and are expert in their subject say, well, this is really something which I'm terribly grateful for.
You're really the one person with all the evidence at your fingertips all around you. What are your conclusions as to his worth as an investigator?
I think his idea was to get the subject official recognition and draw it into the open air and make it a science, you see. And I don't really think he can be said to have succeeded, because I don't think you can make it into a science. Of course, there is this difficulty of how far he was actually glorifying himself while he did this. But even then, I think we must give him, you know, the benefit of the doubt.
Not everyone takes as charitable a view of Price's reputation as Alan Wesencraft, Peter Bond, and Anita Gregory, for instance.
He was clearly a man with a tremendous need to matter. He was not a man one should look on as a dispassionate scientist. He was a self-advertiser. He was a bit of an egomaniac. It's understandable, perhaps in a day when, not coming from an educated background, a proper hearing would be denied to him. I think, therefore, you know, to see him in balance, one must see that he was labouring under tremendous handicaps. And to overcome them, he unfortunately did not choose the path of sterling integrity. but that of shameless self-advertisement.
Where it suited his book to be able to debunk a medium. He could keep the scientists and the cynic happy on his side. Where it suited his book to say that he believed in something, he hadn't got any hesitation in saying so. So he had a foot in both camps, and I think he played both to suit his own ends with great success, I might say. There's a certain admiration for the chap.
Peter Underwood also has a high opinion of both the man and his achievements.
I think he broke a lot of new ground. He really opened up the whole field of psychical research for the man in the street. I mean, nobody had heard of a poltergeist until Harry Price came along. I think he wanted to discover as much as he possibly could. And if he found fraud, he exposed it. And if he found what he thought was truth, then he said so. And actually what motivated him, I don't really know. But I think it was, deep down, this feeling that he'd got to find whatever was there.
Did all this happen after his death, or were there accusations of fraudulence and so on during his lifetime?
No, there were no accusations whatsoever while he was alive. And I think that's very significant, because the people that I've spoken to who knew him all said that no one would dare to say anything like this when he was alive and able to defend himself.
I don't think he'd ever cheat. I don't think he'd ever cheat. He began an investigation. He wouldn't know what was the truth or not truth about it, you see. But he would work it up to make a story out of it, you see. And he would not mention anything which went against his views. He was a showman. He put it all up in his things. And then, of course, his books were read a lot, and they were very interesting because it was all a dramatic story, you see.
Certainly there seem to be fewer dramatic stories in psychic research nowadays. The scientific approach that Price so ardently advocated has come about with a vengeance, and he might have found investigations today rather dull as a result.
There's nothing to be investigated now at the FBI. It's all highly statistical. The work is all statistical. You've got to know statistics backwards, and it's extremely boring and dull. There's been nothing like it since, you see. So that's the great difficulty. If all these things happened in the days of Harry Price, why aren't they happening now? But they're not.
Why is that?
Ah, that's the whole point.
You've had no signs or evidence of Harry Price since his death, have you? No signs of him coming across?
No.
Do you expect it?
I don't know that anybody's had Harry Price do, because he antagonized the spiritualists as well, do you see, by saying that a lot of them were frauds. So I've never heard of a sitting in which Harry Price has come through.
And you as a friend, nothing?
No, nothing at all.
So perhaps we ought to let Price have the last word in his own way. He died suddenly at his home in Pulborough, Sussex, in 1948, a loner and a maverick to the end, with a long list of cases on his books still to be investigated. He was 67, a happily married man who never allowed his public career to invade his private life with his wife Constance. Harry Price was also a religious believer, a staunch Church of England man. Where had this lifelong pursuit of the paranormal and the occult finally brought him in the end?
It is the very few grains of genuine phenomena that we so patiently extract from mountains of fraudulent psychic chaff that make the life of a researcher worth living. The truths I have found have not yet been thoroughly explored. That is the job for the universities, in whose care the future of psychical research lies. But I will end with a challenge. Is there a single person who, having carefully studied all the positive evidence I have submitted, dares to assert that this extension of the human faculties does not require investigation? Is there a single person who dares to assert that the genuine phenomena I have recorded are not true? Is there a single person who dares to assert that my life has been wasted? Been wasted? Been wasted? Been wasted?
Are You There, Harry Price? Was written and presented by June Knox Moore. Taking part were Mrs. K.M. Goldney, Anita Gregory, Maurice Barenbell, Peter Bond, Peter Underwood, and Alan Wisencraft. The readers were Edward Kelsey as Harry Price and Patrick Barr. The producer was Barbara Crowther.